I'm Daniel Penny, and you're listening to Non-Toxic, a podcast where we connect the dots between the manosphere and the atmosphere. In part one of this two-parter on climate babies, we talked to Sean Norris, author of the book Bodies Under Siege, which charts the far-right efforts to roll back women's bodily autonomy. And this week, we're going to talk about the other side of the same coin, so from pro-natalists to anti-natalists. When I started putting this episode together, I thought back to the movie First Reformed, which came out in 2017. It stars Ethan Hawke playing a minister in a small upstate New York town who essentially has a crisis of faith after having a really bummer conversation with one of his doomer parishioners. And the reason that the minister is even called to have this conversation is because the parishioner, played by Amanda Seyfried, excellent performance, is pregnant. And her husband, the doomer environmentalist, is becoming increasingly obsessed with the idea that their as yet unborn child will come to live in a fallen world, an unlivable world. And when he expresses these doubts to the minister, neither is really able to convince the other. They both leave feeling that their questions are unanswered. I think a lot of people in their 20s and 30s and 40s have started contemplating being asked that question by children of their own. And the answer can be really unnerving. It's a question that's been prompted in part by realistic concerns about what the future of our planet might look like, as well as older philosophical arguments about the legitimacy of having children at all, what's sometimes called antinatalism. In this episode of Non-Toxic, we're going to go back and look at those philosophical roots and the arguments about risk and the potential for suffering that have come to animate a certain corner of the doomer climate conversation. This season of Non-Toxic is supported by Blue Corn Candles and by listeners like you. If you'd like to support Non-Toxic, go to patreon.com/nontoxicpodcast and become a patron today. For this episode of Non-Toxic, I'm joined by Amanda Oldfant-Sukunik, an antinatalism advocate and host of the podcast Exploring Antinatalism, with whom I'm co-producing this episode. We're talking with one of the foundational thinkers of the modern antinatalist movement, bioethicist and philosopher Madi Hirdi. Madi is the author of A Rational Cure for Pre-Reproductive Stress Syndrome, as well as If You Must Make Babies, Then at Least Make the Best Babies You Can, and a number of other papers and books discussing the ethical dilemmas and risks of having children. He is a professor of business ethics and philosophy of social science in the Department of Management at Aalto University in Helsinki. Thank you both for joining me on this episode of Non-Toxic.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
This first question is for both of you, and I think it'll be useful in just setting the terms of the conversation. I'm hoping that you can define what antinatalism is. Maybe you can kind of set the stage and talk about the particular version of antinatalism that you're most interested in.
I'll just jump in first, I guess. There is no standard definition of antinatalism in English. I have campaigned twice to have the word added to the Oxford English Dictionary to no avail. I think that was back in 2016, 2017. The very simplest way I could define it is that it's a critique of procreation, or it's against the creation of new sentient beings, of new lives. But even that is extremely controversial because some antinatalists would say, no, we're not against lives. We're not against life, we're against human life. But then other antinatalists would say, no, it's about sentience, everything from humans to animals. And then other kinds of antinatalists would say, no, it's even the possibility, it's evolution itself, it's all, you know, existence of anything that could have the possibility of feeling in the universe.
Matty, I know that you got your start in bioethics and you were writing about abortion and euthanasia. Can you kind of link those ideas up for our listeners, like how you transitioned from being a philosopher who was interested in contemporary debates around these bioethical problems to moving into a broader antinatalist ideology?
Well, I am an antinatalist philosopher, so I say these days. And antinatalism for me means three things. I don't have children, I don't intend to have children, and I'm pleased if everybody acts like me in this respect. So that's all I need for antinatalism. Other people define it differently, and that's their thing. Amanda and I are just publishing a book called Antinatalism, Extinction, and the End of Procreative Self-Corruption. And the first part of that tells the story of antinatalism since the Greek antiquity to today, basically. And a very important turn, the second antinatalist challenge there, is early Christianity. Because in early Christianity, the idea was that the world is coming to an end. The second coming of the Christ will happen during the lifetime of the people who live then, like the nuclear thing and like the environmental disaster. And it would be cruel and unkind to have children in this kind of world, which is, well, the story went that the end times will be horrible when Christ comes again. And so it would be cruel for pregnant women, young mothers, and infants to bring any new life into this world. So I don't know if that answers anybody's question, but it just gives you some perspective that it is in our human thinking that we think that some kind of disaster is awaiting around the corner. So let's just think that this might take some of the edge, some of the drama, some of the sense of tragedy out of this.
Matti, talk about the evolution of your thinking and how it is that you became an antinatalist.
I have traveled a long way to become an antinatalist philosopher. Antinatalism didn't exist when I started my career in the 1980s. Nevertheless, in 1984, in my master's dissertation, I defended the right to abortion, which is kind of an antinatalist theme already. In 1994, I published a book called Liberal Utilitarianism and Applied Ethics, and in that I sort of described or presented one negative utilitarian view, but then didn't have the courage to continue on that route. Traditional positive utilitarians thought that we should maximize net good, maximize pleasure over pain, happiness over suffering, well-being over ill-being, whatever your theory of value. Now, negative utilitarians who started shortly before my time in philosophy dropped the good out of the equation and said that we have a duty to minimize suffering. So not maximize good, but to minimize bad. It's more important, they said, to stall bad than it is to increase good. I mean, that's an everyday observation. If you're suffering, then I really have a duty to help you if I can. But if you are unhappy, do I have a duty to make you happy? Hardly. So there's a moral urgency to suffering. And antinatalism follows from this quite naturally, because all human or all sentient lives contain some suffering. So anytime you produce a new life, you produce more suffering to the world, and you go against negative utilitarianism, and you are a bad person, and shame on you. So that's the connection, and I could have made that connection in 30 years ago, but I didn't, because the consequence of or corollary of negative utilitarianism is human extinction. Because if we follow that through logically, then nobody will have children, there will be no new people, in the end eventually humankind will meet its end. And that was an idea too horrible to behold for philosophers of that time, and so I went to to other places and did something else. I then, about 10 years later, 20 years ago now, sort of came to peace with the idea that, humankind shouldn't exist. I mean, I'm not trying to end human life, but if it goes away voluntarily, we all decide that we are not going to have children and then there will be no humankind in 100 years, then so be it. And of course, there are people who are very much opposed to this idea and are saying that humanity and blah, blah, blah had value and is sacrosanct and what have you.
I think it is a really nice segue into the main topic that I want to discuss with you all, which is the way that the climate crisis has been addressed or is becoming integrated into the conversation around antinatalism. Because I know that risk is a really core idea to your understanding of antinatalism. And in the case of the climate crisis, there are so many unknown risks that we now face. And I think people who are contemplating having children have a really difficult time assessing what those risks might be. Because it, as you say, in If You Must Have Children, if people insist on having children, it would probably be good or rational to make sure that the lives of these children will be as good as possible. And I think it's very difficult now for anyone to assess whether or not the lives of their children will be good.
One of my earliest memories is that when I was 8 years old, I remember lying in the snow, looking at the starry sky above me and feeling, sensing this certainty that none of this matters because the world will be destroyed by a nuclear holocaust before I get to adulthood anyway. So that was a consoling thought. But anyways, it didn't happen. Had it happened, it would have been pretty bad, I think, and even worse than our environmental crisis now, at least for a long time. And well, it depends on from where you're looking. I mean, if you're in Seychelles and your island will drown in 20 years, then of course your angle is different from mine sitting on top of a hill in Helsinki. And anyway, so if people are thinking about not having children because of these threats, then fair enough.
This episode of Non-Toxic is sponsored by Blue Corn Candles, a Colorado-based company that's been making handcrafted beeswax candles since 1991. Most candles in the market are made of paraffin, a diesel byproduct that's literally scraped from the bottom of the barrel. Blue Corn Candles are made from sustainably harvested and lightly filtered beeswax. The candles smell great, burn super slowly, and most importantly, they don't produce any toxic fumes. For the first time, Blue Corn has launched a new line of scented candles based on the rugged landscapes of Colorado. From the sagebrush-covered foothills of Ridgeway to the pine forests of Telluride. During these dark months, Blue Corn is running a special deal for Non-Toxic listeners. Enter the code NONTOXIC, that's one word, all caps, at checkout to receive 10% off your order, shipping within the US and internationally. And now, back to our show. Amanda, are you noticing more people coming to you or interacting with your podcast because of a concern about climate? Is that something that you are seeing in conversations in the anti-natalist community?
You know, it's interesting because 1991 was the start of the voluntary human extinction movement. You could say that they were like the first organized antinatalists, although that word wasn't around yet. And they were an environmentalist movement. And then there was also the Church of Euthanasia. They were sort of propelled by the growing climate crisis. And those groups are still around. And interestingly enough, you know, there is the existence of something like Birth Strike, you know, which again is an environmentalist movement. But Blythe Pepino, who's the founder of Birth Strike, has made some very public statements wanting to distance herself and Birth Strike from antinatalism entirely. I think climate activists are afraid of antinatalism, probably because it's conflated with population control often. And so, and obviously population control has this horrific, you know, history of racial injustice, which is not anything to do with what antinatalism is about. And so everything has been kept very separate. And of course, you know, there are strains of antinatalism where that, you know, don't wish to cause harm, you know, are not happy that climate change is happening and that's going to cause tremendous amounts of suffering. If you believe that the climate crisis is coming, which I do, you know, I do believe we're in serious trouble, that's a perfectly good reason not to bring a child into the world.
So it's the question of your definition of antinatalism. Amanda and I interviewed in the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, Paul Ehrlich, the author of the book,
The Population Bomb.
The Population Bomb. And he had a really hard time understanding our kind of antinatalism as a concept at all. You mean no people? Because antinatalism for him means fewer people. He kept saying things like less than two children each and everything will be hunky-dory. And that's not our idea at all. That leads to population control. That leads to women losing their autonomy first in the global south and then everywhere else. But that's not antinatalism for us, at least, because we are universal, consistent antinatalists. Nobody should have children. You would be pleased if nobody had children. So we are not saying that these people can have children, those people cannot have children. That's selective pronatalism. And selective pronatalists should get that load and not us. Nice universal antinatalists.
I know that for a lot of antinatalists, suffering is the core problem. And then the question is what to do about suffering. Is it just restricted to human suffering? Or as you've said, it sounds like there are some thinkers who believe that all life is suffering and therefore all life should end. Other people seem to take the position that maybe humans are the cause of most of the suffering and therefore human life should end and we should let the rest of the earth continue spinning on without our presence. Can you just kind of lay out what those distinctions are and how you're thinking through them? Because I think, you know, there is definitely a component of the climate movement who are described as kind of like doomers, essentially.
Yeah.
And they, I would say, basically have like a human antinatalist perspective where they think that humans are the cause of so much environmental destruction and therefore we should let the human race, you know, die out and give the planet a chance to recover. How are you all grappling with that idea?
Yes. I mean, what you're describing, I think, could most commonly be referred to as like anthropocentric antinatalism, or the voluntary human extinction movement essentially takes. I don't know that they would ever call themselves doomers per se, but they sort of take what's called a misanthropic view or use the misanthropic arguments for antinatalism that humans are causing all of this destruction, that humans should go extinct and that the animals should inherit the earth. So that's one form of antinatalism. There's also child-free, which sometimes isn't considered a part of antinatalism at all. Sometimes it is. There's more overlap these days than there ever has been. And you could say that the child-free movement is most concerned with, you know, I'd like to invest in my own life. I just don't want to have children. I want to have, you know, enough money and I want to be able to travel. And I don't mean to grossly generalize it, but it can sort of be seen as a lifestyle choice more than having some sort of ethical or philosophical bent to it.
I'm curious to get a sense of the gender composition of the antinatalist community. It seems like most of the people who recently spoke at that conference that you both were a part of were men. And I just get the sense that there are a lot more men in this movement than women. And I think that for women especially, there is very strong social pressure to reproduce and that you do not fulfill your life schema unless you have a child. I think there are a lot more men who can kind of take it or leave it. And given the number of absent fathers in this world, there are plenty of men who even though they reproduce, have no actual relationship with their child, and so they may as well not have reproduced at all. And I'm curious kind of how that plays out in the conversations that you all are having.
Yeah, I mean, first I want to say that there's been almost no like survey material done of the antinatalist community. There's no real statistical studies that have ever been done. So it's hard to say, but from all appearances, it may very well be the case that there's an equal number of men and women within antinatalism. But as far as, you know, who becomes content producers, who actually creates public identities around being an antinatalist, it's most commonly men. Conversely, in the child-free movement, it's mostly women. So there is this very unusual sort of gender divide amongst anti-procreation that it appears that for whatever reason, for perhaps a host of reasons, antinatalism is for boys and child-free is for girls. And I really do think that there's a number of reasons for this. I mean, there's a very famous child-free antinatalist author and activist in Germany named Verena Brunschweiger, and I had her on the Exploring Antinatalism podcast and asked her about this. And, you know, she talked about how, you know, she thinks that the social cost of aligning oneself for women with something like antinatalism is just too incredibly high, that it's just, you know, to be seen as somebody that's involved in something sort of negative and not very lovely, is the words that she used, is it's just sort of more than most women can afford, because that may have huge implications on who their friends can be, what kind of partners they can have. I think it's very different, especially in since reproductive autonomy is so under attack, the concept that your womb is really not this like marvelous, wonderful thing, but it's dangerous. It's just as dangerous as an unruly erection. You know what I mean? It's like it's something that birth is an aggressive act. It's not a gift. It's a slap in the face. That's really difficult for a lot of women to hear, that implication, and it sounds really misogynistic when it's not intended. And not helping that is that there is a lot of misogyny in the antinatalist community. There's a high instance of MGTOWs and incels, and so that also makes it sort of difficult for a lot of women to be public.
That's fascinating. I hadn't considered the prevalence of incels in the antinatalist community, but it makes a lot of sense. Like, if no one wants to have sex with you, then you might as well go down the path of like, well, I don't want to reproduce, so joke's on you.
I don't want your baby anyway. Yeah.
Which obviously is, you know, brings with it a community of people that maybe you need to manage or need to kind of deprogram, because there are a lot of other quite toxic beliefs that come along with being an incel, especially the sense that, you know, people are not equal.
The incel angle, Amanda, is something that we need to study further at some point, because there's the most theoretical concept for it. It's called adaptive preference for sour grapes in ordinary English, which just means that if you can't get it, then no one else will get it either. Or, well, of course, there's the benign interpretation that you get used to it and you stoically change your attitude or whatever. But Amanda, we'll have to make a note of that.
I want to end our conversation with a discussion of maybe a little bit more of your personal lives and what antinatalism has meant in them. I know that you both have been thinking about these issues for many years at this point, and I want to hear a little bit about the evolution of your views, as well as kind of where antinatalism has led you in your personal lives.
When I finally did discover people talking about this idea, it was like being struck by lightning. It just was just the thing that I had been looking for my entire life, and really did propel, 14 years now of just a massive amount of creative and intellectual energy in me. And so I've gone on to produce, you know, just thousands of videos on the subject, many podcasts, not just the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, many podcasts, a film by the name of The Effortless in 2016. Of course, Mati and I have written an academic paper now and a book, and caused me to go to graduate school. And it's really brought an incredible number of very positive things to my life. And I do get up every day because I am compelled to work towards this prevention of new lives and as much suffering as I possibly can while I'm still alive.
Your life is better because you want to end lives and you've realized that.
Yeah. Yeah. In a matter of speaking, yes.
Amazing. Mati?
In 1980, I decided with my then wife that we should have children. We should have twins, a boy and a girl, genetically manipulated. Genetic manipulation hardly existed in those days, so we had these science fiction ideas, apparently. These twins would be called Peter and Susan, and we'd go to university, and they'd be in our bags, and we'd carry them around, and they'd be our little trophies. She went to a gynecologist who, in no uncertain term, told that this is not possible. And then adaptive preference, sour grapes, we decided that it's not worth it anyway. So who wants to have children anyway? So from that moment on, I have been childless. Before that, I was a potential breeder. In 1995, in a conference, I have a horrible headache. And decide that life value can be negative as well as positive or zero. At the same time, people at the conference were talking about children born with HIV. So women who had HIV became pregnant. And then if they gave birth, there was a 50-50 chance that the child will be born with HIV, infected with HIV, live a few weeks, suffer horribly and die. And I said that that's unthinkable and it's intolerable. And they said that my view is intolerable. We should always celebrate life and blah, blah. And I, with my tail between my legs, went home and then forgot about that. So many of my academic friends at the turn of the millennium were just there at the age when they were having children and made children at that. And so they were 35 and thought that if they were to avoid Down syndrome, they should do it now. And they were really happy about their children and they were really happy about the prospect. So I didn't have the heart to rub it in any way, but they knew about it. And some of them were really hurt by it clearly. And so forth. One of the reasons why I sort of retracted from the scene, because it's not nice to have that reaction from people. In a couple of years' time, I had a new partner. And with that new partner in Cowbridge, Wales, we discussed the world situation and the risks involved in life. And we decided that if we had a big button that we could press that would annihilate the whole world, we would do it. Our views differed on that, that she was of the opinion that now that we have found out this, after this revelation, all our waking moments from then on should be spent in creating a real-life button, of course. Otherwise, we'll be bad persons. And being the lazy person that I am, I sort of wriggled it out of it by saying, oh, people's autonomy and all that. They should get to freely choose if they go from here.
Okay, so that's how you didn't become a Bond villain.
Yes.
You almost did, but you narrowly averted it.
Yes. But since then, I've openly admitted that I would press the button.
I think the way I want to end this conversation sort of harkens back to the beginning. You both talked about some ancient roots of antinatalist thought, Egyptian pyrrhi and Greek antiquity. So antinatalism as an ideology or ideologies or maybe just an instinct, has been around with us and developing with human life, which of course is a sort of contradiction. What is coming around the corner for antinatalism that is going to make the difference and finally get people to stop breeding?
May I start this one, Amanda?
Of course, go right ahead.
Because I can give the the historical timeline and the reason for my pessimism. We tell the history of antinatalism in cycles or in phases. Now, in the book that we mentioned a couple of times, we start telling the history of antinatalism from the ancient Greeks realizing that life has no cosmic meaning and being in a pretty bad shape about that. Then they combine this with some early scientific ideas about pleasure and pain being very important. And then is it Democritus saying that children shouldn't be had because they are a nuisance and something like that. So this is the first antinatalist challenge or alarm. And then the first response to this is, interestingly, Plato's philosophy. Because Plato is explaining that, yes, there is a meaning, and then he tells this story about there being a demiurge or a god who has created the world out of deficient material because the good stuff went into building the stars and planets and what have you. So human beings are insufficient and incomplete. And then because of this, they have to suffer a lifetime on Earth to become perfect and then to return to their home stars whence they came from. Then comes Christianity and the second antinatalist alarm. The Gnostics and others saying that the Christ is coming back soon. Let's not have children. Other people saying that flesh is evil. Let's go with the spirit, not with the flesh. And so on and so forth. Now, the second reaction then again is to Christianize, to philosophize Christianity, first by Augustine of Hippo, then by St. Thomas of Aquinas. And on it goes. Then there's a third alarm, then there's a third response, and we are still in there, and we don't know which alarm we are talking about now. But I will tell you one thing about the history before I let Amanda loose on what happens next, and that is that A.N. Whitehead, the British logician 100 years ago, famously said that all Western philosophy is just footnotes to Plato's philosophy. Now, as we show in the book, that Plato's philosophy is a book note to antinatalism, then all Western philosophy is actually just very long list of complaints and rebuttals of antinatalism. Because of our work, Amanda, and my work, we know that, oh, it's all about antinatalism, and philosophy has just been a way to stall the progress. So will it succeed this time? We'll hear in the next episode of what Amanda says.
It's hard at this particular stage of time to figure out what's ringing the alarm bells right now. I mean, there is sort of an unfortunate cannibalistic aspect to the antinatalist community itself. Will our disgust with each other because of our disagreements with one another be what silences antinatalism this time? I don't know. I think Mati and I are both sort of big tent antinatalists because this thing has such potential to do so much good in the world, to do all the good, I think, actually. All we can do is just keep pressing on, keep creating new works, try to make more antinatalist works faster than the natalists can keep producing children, if possible, and just creating the best tools that we possibly can for the antinatalists of the future. There are children alive today, and there are children not yet conceived, children in the womb now who will be antinatalists of the future. So my goal is to just, you know, till the soil well enough for them to be able to pass it on, because unfortunately they will exist, and hopefully we can give them the tools to make sure that they will be the last.
All right. On that note, Amanda, Mati, thank you so much for coming on Non-Toxic. It was fascinating, and I really appreciate the opportunity to hear from you both.
Thanks so much for having us, Daniel.
If you spend much time working on the science or policy behind climate, or if you're part of the chattering classes like me, thoughts of the future often bring with them a sense of despair. This past year broke records for global temperatures, and most of the planet's engine lights are flashing red. In 2023, waters off the southeast coast of the U.S. were rising at a rate of half an inch a year, and the U.S. sustained 28 climate disasters with losses exceeding $1 billion each. Yet President Biden opened more federal land for drilling, bringing U.S. oil production to its highest ever in 2024. It feels a bit like we're Thelma and Louise, collectively driving our car off a cliff and into the Grand Canyon. In a recent report from Yale's Program on Climate Change Communication, 13% of Americans surveyed believed it was, quote, already too late to do anything about global warming, end quote. If you take that view, then it follows that you shouldn't have children, since life will be much worse for them than it has been for you. Of course, you could look at the same data with the glass more than half full. 66% of Americans rejected climate fatalism in that survey, perhaps naively. I suppose I'm somewhere in the remaining 21%, unsure of just how bad the future will be, but certain it's not going to be as cushy as the present. When it comes to my own family planning, I don't have a kid yet myself, and I'm not sure I ever will. Some of that boils down to economics. Journalism is not a lucrative profession, as well as a general sense that I might be better suited to be a dog dad than a father to a human child. My partner and I have talked about adoption, and it's still on the table, but it's also prohibitively expensive. The laws of supply and demand being what they are, I sometimes darkly joke that we only need to wait a few years for climate disasters to get worse and produce more climate orphans, and then it'll be easier to adopt. But I hope that future doesn't really come to pass. Still, it's hard for me to imagine why anybody would bother to fight for a better world if there were no future generations to inhabit it. When it comes to climate action, the moral claims of youth activists are the strongest and simplest to understand, in my opinion. The old in charge today are destroying the future of the young. Dick Cheney will die before facing the climate consequences of his actions. It's kind of amazing he's still alive, actually. I've been casting about lately, searching for an alternative to the nihilism that seems to follow from the idea that there is no future, or at least, no future with my offspring in it. One of the traditional tenets of Iroquois governance is this idea of seventh-generation thinking, that the impact of any major decision or relationship should be considered from the vantage of your great-great-great-great-grandchildren. But I suppose we might extend that to the collective children and grandchildren of your community, or perhaps broader still, to your country, your planet, to see all of those children as our children. And that's it for this episode of Non-Toxic. Next week, we'll be talking with the author Nathaniel Rich about his book Losing Earth, A Recent History, which charts the emergence of a consensus around the science of climate change and attempts by scientists and activists in the late 1970s through the 1980s to get the U.S. government to make a concerted effort to fix things. This is, in a sense, the window of opportunity and how it is that we missed it. As always, I'm your host, Daniel Penny. Non-Toxic was produced by Loose Thread Studios with help from Andrew Lewis. Music is by Nathan Sharp, and our artwork is by Sam Creasy. And a special thanks to Amanda at the Exploring Antinatalism podcast. This season of Non-Toxic is supported by Blue Corn Candles and by listeners like you. To support the show, you can go to patreon.com/nontoxicpodcast and sign up to become a patron today. If you'd like to keep detoxifying the discourse, we could use your help. And don't forget to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps other people find the show.